For years, the most violent armed conflict taking place in the Western Hemisphere has been raging like an inferno across Mexico, consisting of various different cartel factions all vying against one another for power, influence, and the control of lucrative narcotics trade routes and markets in the United States. This war within Mexico between the cartels and against the Mexican government has claimed the lives of around 400,000 people through violent crime-related homicides and disappearances since it began in 2006. While the fentanyl and methamphetamine that they've been smuggling across the border have been ravaging America's streets and fueling the US opioid epidemic, where more than 250,000 other people have died from fentanyl overdoses alone just since 2018. The numbers of fentanyl overdose deaths in the US have been rising almost every single year since 2012, to the point where they were 27 times higher in 2022 than a decade previously in 2012. And despite the vast majority of illicit fentanyl originating from labs outside of the country and entering the US by being smuggled by cartels across the border, and despite the fact that the Mexican government has already been officially at war with the cartels ever since 2006, the prospect of the US military stepping in and taking direct action against the cartels in Mexico themselves always seemed like a fringe idea or something out of a movie for years. But over the past few months, with Donald Trump back in office again, that once fringe idea of sending the US military off to its next war with the Mexican cartels across the border has been becoming increasingly more mainstream and plausible. According to a memoir that was written by Mark Esper, Trump's Secretary of Defense during his first term, Trump allegedly asked him privately in 2020 if it would have been possible for the US military to fire missiles at cartel-run drug labs in Mexico and then deny all US responsibility for the attacks afterwards. Trump himself has denied that this interaction ever took place at all. But the rhetoric from him and other Republicans since then on going after the cartels and crushing their fentanyl operations has only grown in fervor. In March of 2023, a group of four American tourists who were mistaken for Haitian smugglers by Mexico's Gulf cartel in the border town of Matamoros were kidnapped and two of them were murdered. Even after the cartel apprehended the men who were allegedly responsible and turned them over to authorities and apologized profusely, the incident sparked an uproar in the United States and led to Republican Senator Lindsey Graham saying that he would introduce legislation to lay the groundwork for the Biden administration to deploy U.S. military force against the Mexican cartels. Something that Mexico's then-president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, better known by his initials as AMLO, rejected on the basis that it would have been a violation of Mexico's sovereignty. But since AMLO left office in Mexico in late 2024 and his political successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, assumed office, the U.S. has been steadily moving the pieces into place to confront the cartels more directly anyway. Shortly after taking office in October of 2024, President Sheinbaum secretly began allowing the CIA for the first time to start running covert surveillance drone flights over Mexican airspace and territory. The extent of this secret CIA surveillance drone program over Mexico wasn't revealed for several more months until an article was released about the program by the New York Times in February of 2025. While not given any authorization to use lethal force, at least for now, the CIA drones have been busy hunting for cartel-run fentanyl labs across Mexican territory instead, whose intelligence is then passed on to Mexican authorities and likely kept by the US for potential future operations. Since returning back to office again, Trump has ordered an increase in the numbers of these CIA reconnaissance drone flights that are taking place over Mexico, while he's also ordered the US military to step up its own separate surveillance flights along the southern border and along Mexico's Pacific coast. Unlike the CIA, the US military does not yet have formal permission to utilize Mexican airspace. But that hasn't stopped the Trump administration from using the military to acquire intelligence on the cartels anyway. Since Trump returned to office, the US military has conducted more than 24 known surveillance flights along the southern border, using a variety of spy planes and drones. Well, in early February, a US Air Force RC-135V rivet joint reconnaissance aircraft carefully threaded the needle of international waters and airspace to fly deep within the Gulf of California, directly by the Mexican state of Sinaloa, home to one of Mexico's largest and most influential cartels, the Sinaloa Cartel. These increased surveillance flights under the Trump administration appear to be gathering intelligence and acquiring targets for potential future attacks, while the Trump administration has also been further laying groundwork for attacks in other ways as well. Trump's pick for the U.S. ambassador to Mexico during this administration is a man named Ronald Johnson, a former Green Beret and a veteran CIA officer with more than 20 years of prior experience leading sensitive paramilitary operations. a pick that suggests the Trump administration's coming posture towards Mexico and the cartels. Between February and March of 2025, the Trump administration sent a detachment of the Green Berets to the Luis Carpizo Naval Facility in the Mexican state of Campeche to conduct joint training exercises with Mexico's elite Naval Marine Corps. While on the 20th of February, the Trump administration took the unprecedented step of formally designating the six largest Mexican cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, or FTOs. The Sinaloa Cartel, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, the Northeast Cartel, La Nueva Familia, the Gulf Cartel, and the United Cartels. Now, historically and practically speaking, the Mexican cartels were never designated by the U.S. government as terrorist organizations in the past, because there's a pretty clear difference between cartels, who are basically businesses, whose ultimate goal is making money, and groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, whose ultimate goals are political change and who are ideologically or religiously motivated instead. Nonetheless, the designation of the Mexican cartels as terrorist organizations by the Trump administration does not immediately open up the door to U.S. air power raining down on them in Mexico. It actually offers up no additional military tools against them all on its own. What it does do, though, is it enables U.S. financial authorities to go after the cartels' finances much more aggressively than they used to be able to do. All organizations designated as terrorist groups by the U.S. government get all of their assets frozen that are under the control of American financial institutions, while their known members are banned from entering the country, and it immediately enables their deportation. However, the most significant thing that happens when a group is designated as an FTO is that it becomes illegal for U.S. citizens and even others to knowingly provide what's called material support for the group. If there's a restaurant somewhere in Mexico that pays protection money to one of the cartels, for example, this would enable the restaurant to get targeted by financial freezes or seizures due to the financial transfers with the cartel. The designation can also come with great unintended financial and economic consequences as well, though. Because of how deeply embedded many of the cartels are within Mexican society, there are countless Mexican businesses that are connected to one in some way or another. For example, for years even before Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, American financial companies like PayPal simply refused to conduct any business in the West Bank at all, out of fear that since Hamas was a designated foreign terrorist organization, and since Hamas was so embedded in the West Bank, that their services might have ended up getting used by someone linked to Hamas. And then, they would get come after by U.S. financial authorities. A similar dilemma could now arise in Mexico, with the six major cartels in the country now designated as foreign terrorist organizations, making U.S.-based banks, payment processors, and other financial companies operating in Mexico potentially susceptible to federal prosecution. Formally designating the six cartels as terrorist organizations also lays the groundwork in America for justifying an intervention against the declared terrorists later. Very shortly after their designation was made, Elon Musk, one of Trump's top advisors, took to X and said that meant they're eligible for drone strikes. Back in November of 2024, Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said that the president was committed to calling the cartels terrorist organizations and using the full might of the U.S. special operations to take them out. While this new Trump administration Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, has also repeatedly refused to rule out the option of drone strikes and other U.S. military actions against the Mexican cartels when pressed about it, even without the express consent of the Mexican government. During a visit to the southwestern border in February, Hegseth publicly refused to rule out launching cross-border raids into Mexico to pursue the cartels, and said that all options remained on the table. But there also appears to be some degree of division within Trump's inner circle on how aggressively to go after the cartels. Based on insider reports, one of the camps in the Trump administration is being led by Sebastian Gorka, Trump's appointed senior director for counterterrorism on the White House National Security Council. Gorka's camp is apparently pushing towards using the U.S. military to aggressively pursue the cartels within Mexico and to destroy their fentanyl operations as quickly as possible, with or without the prior consent of the Mexican government. This camp argues that the urgency of the fentanyl crisis in America demands rapid and decisive action against the cartels, while the other, more cautious camp is apparently being led by Trump's Homeland Security advisor, Stephen Miller, who is allegedly concerned that going too hard on the cartels without the Mexican government's approval could jeopardize the cooperation between the U.S. and Mexican governments on migration and border issues, which could greatly exacerbate the numbers of migrants who are reaching the U.S. border. Mexico's relatively new president herself, Claudia Sheinbaum, has repeatedly asserted that Mexico will never accept unilateral U.S. military actions or drone strikes on Mexican territory. She has insisted that any U.S. military actions taken on Mexican territory without her government's consent would be a gross violation of Mexico's sovereignty, and that Mexico seeks cooperation or coordination with the U.S., not invasion or subordination. She has allowed the CIA to begin conducting those reconnaissance flights over Mexican airspace. She has deployed 10,000 Mexican troops to the northern border to patrol for fentanyl smuggling. She has sent more soldiers and police into the Sinaloa state, where her government has reported nearly 900 arrests just since last October. And she's already begun extraditing more than 24 cartel operatives to the U.S. to stand trial. Nonetheless, in early April, NBC News reported that several unnamed high-level Trump administration officials were still considering launching drone strikes in Mexico against cartel targets soon, even without the Mexican government's approval. And to understand what's happening right now between the U.S. and Mexico and the cartels, it helps to understand a bit of the context behind the drug war's history and how bad the problem has gotten over time. Drug traffickers and criminal groups in Mexico began growing more organized and advanced in the 1980s, after the historical cocaine smuggling route from Colombia to Miami by sea grew more difficult to pull off, which led to the cocaine smuggling route shifting overland to the U.S. southern border through Mexico instead. Criminal drug cartels in Mexico began coalescing in regionally defined areas, and they began fighting against one another and the government for the control of these narcotics trade routes and markets in the U.S. Under President Felipe Calderón, the Mexican government officially declared war on the drug cartels in 2006 and engaged with the U.S. government on a joint campaign to decapitate cartel leadership, something that they called the Kingpin Strategy. For the next 6 years until 2012, American intelligence agencies passed on information about the cartels to the Mexican government. U.S. law enforcement agents cooperated with Mexican law enforcement, and U.S. special forces trained up elite Mexican commandos to go after the cartels themselves. But this initial strategy had its shortcomings. Some of the Mexican special forces that were trained by the American special forces later defected and took their training and expertise with them to form one of the most fearsome Mexican drug cartels, Los Zetas, which later became the Northeast Cartel, which is one of the cartels that is now designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. Targeting cartel leadership also often created power vacuums and triggered fierce succession crises and civil wars within the cartels, which exacerbated the levels of violence further. After Calderón's party was voted out of office in 2012, and Enrique Peña Nieto took over as Mexico's president next, he shifted the strategy away from using the Mexican military to confront the cartels back towards law enforcement agencies, and the joint military operations with the U.S. against the cartels were ended. Nonetheless, despite a brief decrease in homicides in Mexico following President Nieto's reforms, corruption and crime-related violence continue to be serious issues in the country. Near the end of his term in 2016, drug-related homicides in Mexico increased by a staggering 22%, with more than 20,000 people killed that year alone. In 2017, a mass grave that contained the remains of more than 250 victims of drug-related violence was discovered in the country's Veracruz state. And then the violence continued escalating to an all-time high peak of 33,341 reported homicides in 2018, which has remained fairly consistent at levels nearly that high every year since. The murder rate in Mexico continues to remain among the highest in the world, and is more than 3 times as high as it is in the U.S. next door. While between 2017 and 2020, one journalist was killed in Mexico roughly every week on average. Then, after AMLO assumed the Mexican presidency next in 2018, he began pursuing a radically different approach towards the cartels than any of his predecessors. He adopted a new policy that he called Hugs, Not Bullets, in which he sought to address the cartel violence problem by legalizing marijuana, implementing poverty alleviation programs, and rolling out new sentencing guidelines for convicted drug traffickers. He also created a new Mexican National Guard, a sort of hybrid civilian police and military force, to fight against the cartels on the ground. Overall, AMLO took a very hands-off approach towards the cartels in Mexico, which effectively enabled them to flourish like they had never before. AMLO claimed falsely on multiple occasions that no fentanyl was even produced in Mexico at all. AMLO formally withdrew Mexico from a security cooperation agreement with the U.S. in 2021, while the numbers of disappeared people in Mexico skyrocketed under his lax administration. More people disappeared in Mexico under AMLO's presidency than during both of his predecessors combined. During the final year of his administration in 2024, an average of 37 people in Mexico disappeared every single day, while more than 120,000 people in Mexico are now listed as officially missing. So while the official homicide rate declined slightly under AMLO's leadership, the disappearance rate also skyrocketed at the same time. And since missing people are not counted by the Mexican government statistics as homicides, the true homicide rate when counting the dramatic increases in missing people since 2018 is likely far higher than the official Mexican data suggests it is. And the problems of violence and smuggling both got much worse under AMLO's watch, while the cartels grew increasingly more powerful. As it currently stands now in 2025, it's been estimated by the US military that the various competing cartels in Mexico now de facto control around one-third of the entire country's territory, putting the Mexican government on a level of de facto control within their country that's about on a par with a recognized failed state like the Syrian government. Between all of the cartels combined today are an estimated 160,000 to 185,000 armed fighters and mercenaries, almost half the size of the standing Mexican armed forces themselves. Large swaths of the country in Mexico that are under cartel influence are more controlled by the cartels than by the actual government, which is why the US State Department currently still maintains a level 4 do not travel advisory to the Mexican states of Colima, Guerrero, Michoacán, Sinaloa, Tamaulipas, and Zacatecas, where cartel activities and influence are particularly well pronounced. In addition, corruption and cartel influence across the Mexican government also runs extremely deeply. A report by the American DEA found evidence that the cartels had funneled millions of dollars into the 2006 presidential campaign of AMLO, for example. In 2020, U.S. law enforcement arrested the former Mexican defense secretary while he was visiting Los Angeles, on a sprawling indictment that accused him of accepting bribes from one of the cartels, and of using his position to assist with drug smuggling. Well, in 2024, the former Mexican Secretary of Public Security was also sentenced to 38 years in prison for his role in accepting bribes from the Sinaloa cartel. Facts that now present significant challenges to the prospect of the U.S. military cooperating with the Mexican government against the cartels. If the cartel's influence extends high enough up through the government to the Mexican president's own cabinet positions, to what extent can the Mexican government be trusted to not leak information about impending U.S. military plans to the cartels? It's for this reason why the more hawkish members of the Trump administration advocate for more heavy-handed unilateral military action against the cartels, even without the support of the Mexican government, which they view as being too corrupt and compromised by the cartels themselves. Now, while there are multiple cartels operating within Mexico today, the biggest and most fearsome two right now are the Sinaloa and the Jalisco New Generation cartels. And they are the two that will most likely become the targets of any potential direct U.S. military attacks involving drone strikes or special forces raids. These two large cartels are responsible for the overwhelming majority of narcotics that enter into the United States today, including nearly all of the illicit fentanyl and methamphetamine in America. What sets the Sinaloa cartel apart from the others, in particular, is also the cartel's very close ties to China and the fentanyl trade route. The Sinaloa cartel dominates Mexico's Pacific port of Mazatlan within their home Sinaloa state, through which they're able to import large quantities of precursor chemicals necessary for fentanyl production from China. Sinaloa cartel chemical brokers will purchase Chinese-made chemical ingredients for fentanyl and then smuggle them into Mexico, where they arrive at the cartel's drug labs and are transformed into high-grade synthetic fentanyl, in either pill or powder form, which is then smuggled across the border into the United States, carried in smaller packages by individual drug mules, or in large quantities co-mingled with legitimate trade goods carried by trailers, where they have been ravaging American communities for years. Drug-related overdose deaths in the U.S. have been steadily rising since the 2010s, as the supply of fentanyl and methamphetamine into the country from Mexico has increased too, to the point where in 2022 alone, the CDC reported that more than 107,000 Americans died from drug-related overdoses, 70% resulting from fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, and the other 30% resulting from methamphetamine and other synthetic stimulants, the majorities of both of which come into the country through the Sinaloa and the Jalisco New Generation cartels. It is the deadliest and most serious drug epidemic that the United States has ever faced in its history, and the sheer brazenness of the Sinaloa cartel's willingness to partner with chemical companies from the biggest U.S. state adversary to flood the U.S. with synthetic drugs underscores how serious of a problem this has become. But the flow of deadly drugs like fentanyl and methamphetamine in one direction from Mexico north to the U.S. is only one half of the problem. The other half of this problem that's often left out of these conversations in the American context is the simultaneously enormous flow of weapons and arms in the other direction southward from the U.S. across the border into Mexico. Throughout the entirety of Mexico right now, there is only just a single legal gun store to purchase firearms at. And yet, despite that, there are millions of firearms that can be easily found in Mexico that were manufactured in the United States. It's been estimated that somewhere between 200,000 and 500,000 U.S.-made firearms are smuggled south across the border into Mexico every single year. A problem so significant that Mexican authorities often refer to it as the Iron River. The Mexican government has claimed that between 70 to 90% of the guns used for crimes in Mexico have been illegally trafficked into the country from the U.S. While the U.S. government itself has reported that more than 40% of the illegal firearms seized by authorities in Mexico over a five-year period came exclusively from the state of Texas. So while the cartels have flooded the American side of the border with synthetic drugs that have fueled America's opioid and drug epidemics, it can also be argued that American gun manufacturers and sellers have also flooded the Mexican side of the border with firearms that has fueled the violence and war surrounding the cartels in Mexico's long drug war. And as a result of this long Iron River, the cartels have been steadily able to transform themselves into some of the most powerful and well-equipped non-state actors in the world. They are now known to possess heavy weaponry like belt-fed Gatling guns, armored personnel carriers, and even their own custom-made tank contraptions that are usually called narco-tanks. The cartels are also known to have adept bomb-making skills and a proficiency in using IEDs, as evidenced by a recent incident in 2023 when Tucson, Arizona Border Patrol agents came under fire from cartel members, and then, after pursuing them, discovered 10 cartel-placed IEDs along the border. As early as 2010, the cartels have also made a pioneering use of drones in multiple applications to deliver drugs across the border, to navigate the flows of migrants from above in real time, and as weapons to attack their enemies with. Apparently, having taken lessons from the war in Ukraine, the Mexican cartels have recently been using drones to drop explosives on their enemies during assassination or terror campaigns. The cartels are also known to possess an arsenal of landmines. While recent reported weapon seizures from Mexican authorities indicates that their arsenals may be becoming even more sophisticated. In early 2024, Mexican authorities reported to have seized a heat-seeking FIM-92 Stinger surface-to-air missile from the Sinaloa cartel, which is theoretically capable of downing a commercial airliner. While shortly afterwards, Mexican authorities also reported to have separately seized two U.S.-made Javelin anti-tank systems from the Jalisco New Generation cartel, meaning that the two most powerful cartels right now are likely advanced enough to have significant anti-air and anti-tank capabilities. Regardless, while significantly out-equipping most law enforcement agencies in Mexico, the cartels' firepower, training, and capabilities are still nowhere near on the same scale as the U.S. military is. Probably the biggest obstacle standing in the way of the U.S. military actually attacking the cartels then are the multiple legal roadblocks standing in the way instead. Since the Mexican government has repeatedly made it explicitly clear that they will never consent to unilateral U.S. military actions on Mexican territory and have sworn to defend their sovereignty, international law prohibits the United States from taking military action in Mexico except through a very narrow exception. Article 2, paragraph 4 of the UN Charter explicitly prohibits the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. However, Article 51 of the UN Charter later also carves out a narrow exception to this, noting that nothing in the Charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a UN member. It's conceivable, then, that in order to justify U.S. military strikes on Mexican cartels through the lens of international law, the Trump administration would probably try to argue that the level of destruction and death that's been caused in America by the cartels' fentanyl and methamphetamine smuggling operations entitles it to use military force against them on Mexican territory while acting in self-defense. Regardless of how destructive the fentanyl and methamphetamine crisis has been in America, however, the smuggling of those narcotics into the US does not really represent an armed attack on the country in the way that Article 51 of the UN Charter envisioned. Thus, without the Mexican government's cooperation, any US military strikes on the cartels in Mexico would almost certainly be interpreted as a violation of international law at best, and could be interpreted as an act of war on Mexico at worst. Especially if the strikes end up killing large numbers of Mexican civilians, which are likely. This is the same counsel that Trump's former defense secretary, Mark Esper, is said to have cautioned about when Trump allegedly first brought up the idea of firing missiles at drug labs in Mexico back in 2020. It would put the bilateral relationship between the US and Mexico into an irreversible nosedive, and it could lead to massive unintended consequences, like Mexico simply deciding to stop cooperating with the US altogether on migration issues along the border. Mexico is, to put it politely, also extremely sensitive to the US military taking unilateral actions inside of their country. In the early 20th century, the US military repeatedly intervened in Mexico's affairs and conducted operations on Mexico's territory without the government's consent. In 1914, the US military decided to seize and occupy the Mexican port of Veracruz for 7 months, that killed around 160 Mexicans in the process. While for 10 months between 1916 and 1917, the US sent around 10,000 of their soldiers across the border into the Chihuahua state of Mexico in a manhunt for Pancho Villa, a Mexican revolutionary whose forces had attacked a border town in New Mexico. Throw in the very long history of US and CIA-led operations throughout the Latin America region for the past century, and you get an idea of why Mexico wouldn't exactly trust the intentions of the US military and the CIA operating in Mexico again next. Nonetheless, the recent actions of the US military and of Trump himself during his first term in office may be indicative of what actions they'll ultimately take against the Mexican cartels next. The US military and the Obama administration, after all, didn't really care at all about Pakistan's sovereignty or asking Pakistan for prior permission before they sent in a SEAL team deep into Pakistan to kill Osama bin Laden in 2011, due to fears that the Pakistani government was potentially compromised and might have tipped bin Laden off if they knew about it. While Trump himself has historically been very against large-scale US troop deployments like in Iraq or Afghanistan, he frequently authorized drone and missile strikes and special forces raids to expand and intensify other conflicts. In 2017 and 2018, he ordered US missile strikes in Syria against the Assad regime in response to their use of chemical weapons, which was also probably a violation of the UN Charter. He authorized the special forces raid in Syria in 2019 that killed the leader of ISIS. And perhaps most indicative of how he might act in Mexico, Trump also authorized the controversial drone strike that killed General Qasem Soleimani in early 2020. 8 months before that drone strike, the Trump administration designated Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, one of the branches of the Iranian state military, as a terrorist organization. Soleimani was then the commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, basically Iran's version of the CIA. While he was at the airport in Baghdad, Iraq in early 2020, Trump authorized a drone strike that assassinated him without asking for approval first from the Iraqi government. The drone strike killed 10 people, including Soleimani, and enraged the Iraqi government, which characterized the incident as a violation of its national sovereignty and considered it a breach of its security arrangement with the United States. Shortly afterward, the Iraqi parliament passed a non-binding resolution to expel all remaining American troops from the country. The incident also might have set a precedent for the Trump administration's potential future actions in Mexico, since Trump had the IRGC designated as a terrorist organization and then ordered a drone strike on their most senior leader just 8 months later without requesting approval of the government where the drone strike took place in beforehand. Similar actions could also take place in the future against the now terrorist-designated cartel leadership in Mexico. So based on Trump's own historical preferences for taking covert actions against designated terrorist groups, like drone strikes and limited special forces raids, these are probably the same kinds of tactics that he's currently thinking about applying to the Mexican cartels as well. While he's probably also using the CIA drone flights that are already taking place over Mexico, and the military surveillance flights that are already taking place along the borders and coastlines of Mexico, to build out a targeting deck for future attacks. Nonetheless, there will be multiple problems with straight-up military attacks on the cartels beyond all of the legal and geopolitical issues. Fentanyl, in particular, is produced completely differently than plant-based drugs are. fentanyl can be produced in large quantities in relatively small labs. And the cartel's fentanyl labs are often located in densely populated, crowded urban areas and in people's own homes. Targeting these labs with drone strikes has very high potential to cause mass civilian casualties, which would further inflame tensions between the Mexican and U.S. governments. Sending in special forces raids instead to attack the labs on the ground could also result in American soldiers becoming casualties or getting captured by the cartels or even by the Mexican government, also sparking a major potential political crisis. Moreover, fentanyl labs are also low-tech and much easier to replace than conventional plant-based drug production is. Blowing up or capturing a bunch of fentanyl labs does nothing to stop the cartels from just setting up more of them afterwards, especially so long as the demand for synthetic narcotics within the US remains unchanged and lucrative. The Trump administration's idea would be to employ maximum military pressure on the cartels by assassinating their leaders, blowing up their labs, and disrupting their logistics in order to try and compel them into abandoning the fentanyl and methamphetamine trade to the United States, and to critically abandon their commercial relationships with state adversaries like China, particularly acute for the Sinaloa cartel's close business with China in the overall fentanyl supply chain. In some ways, there's already a few early signs that this strategy could actually kind of be working. Just this February, open source intelligence appeared to indicate that the Metros and the Grupo Escorpion cartels managed to broker a ceasefire between them in the Mexican border state of Tamaulipas, and that their ceasefire terms notably included a call to end their fentanyl trafficking into South Texas, potentially out of a fear of incurring the overwhelming wrath of the U.S. military and their foreign terrorist organization designations. On the one hand, the cartels are not ideological terror organizations and they effectively operate as businesses. When ideological terror organizations like Al-Qaeda or ISIS are attacked, they often dig themselves in and continue the fight no matter how badly their organization gets bloodied. If the cartels begin losing access to their revenue streams and their resources begin coming under threat by the military, they, on the other hand, are much more likely to adapt and negotiate instead of continuing on fighting without the ideological incentive. But at the same time, there's also a risk that taking direct U.S. military action against the cartels will also encourage the cartels to retaliate in uncertain and unpredictable ways. Historically, the cartels have avoided deliberately attacking American citizens out of a fear of encouraging a U.S. military response, as evidenced by the Gulf Cartel's apology in 2023 after they mistakenly killed those two American citizens. However, if the U.S. military was already actively bombing their drug labs and assassinating their leadership with special forces raids, they would have no more incentive to show any restraint. And they might even be incentivized to begin carrying out attacks targeting Americans for leverage and reprisals to try and force the U.S. government into halting their attacks. There are around 1.6 million U.S. citizens who currently live in Mexico, who might find themselves the target of attacks in the crossfire, to say nothing of the millions of American tourists who travel to Mexico every single year. No matter which option the Trump administration ultimately takes towards the cartels south of the border, risks abound. Cooperating with the Mexican government against the cartels risks critical information leaking to the cartels through corrupt Mexican government officials, while sidelining the Mexican government altogether and attacking the cartels unilaterally risks crashing the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico and compromising their historical cooperation on the border and migration, while it further risks incentivizing the cartels to begin initiating terroristic attacks on American citizens and U.S. interests, potentially exacerbating the conflict and drawing the U.S. military further into the war in another Afghanistan in the mountains south of the border. Any chance of being successful in the long run can also not be simply based on attacking the cartel's operations and leadership and eliminating their members. So long as the unquenchable demand for narcotics in the U.S. still remains high, so long as the flow of guns back across the border from the U.S. into Mexico remains unchecked like an iron river, and so long as the Mexican government's authority over its own territory remains decentralized, weak, and corrupt, the problem will just continue persisting, and new cartels and leaders will just replace the ones that are destroyed to fill in the power vacuum. A multifaceted approach to the long drug war is needed that also addresses the root causes of the conflict in the first place. But addressing those root causes will be no simple task. The Mexican drug war for years has been among the most violent, destructive, and longest-lasting conflicts of the entire 21st century that has evolved through multiple phases that have seen many different cartels and leaders come and go throughout the years. Crushing one cartel and eliminating their leadership without addressing the root causes will never put an end to the conflict. And no other cartel leader throughout this entire conflict has been as powerful or as well-known as Joaquin Guzman, better known by his nickname of El Chapo, whose arrest and extradition to the United States in 2017 did nothing to end the drug war's violence and chaos. El Chapo was the leader of Mexico's Sinaloa cartel for years. And at his height, he was arguably even more powerful than Pablo Escobar had managed to become in Colombia in the 1980s. His sprawling empire was once estimated to be responsible for an entire quarter of all the illegal drugs that were entering into the United States, largely through a network of at least 90 underground tunnels that he had ordered constructed between the U.S. and Mexico. A multi-billionaire, El Chapo is believed to be personally responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people, and for years he was the most wanted man in the Western Hemisphere, with a total amount of bounties on his head that nearly equaled $10 million. Constantly elusive, he managed to escape prison multiple times after being arrested, most infamously in 2015 when he escaped from Mexico's Altiplano Maximum Security Prison through an elaborate tunnel that he had his men construct beneath the prison without being noticed. After that escape, El Chapo became arguably the most wanted fugitive in the entire world by both the U.S. and Mexican governments, and a worldwide manhunt for his recapture began, the scale of which has rarely ever been seen before or since. I also made an entire video about the years-long manhunt for El Chapo and how the U.S. and Mexican governments were eventually able to locate and capture him in my Modern Conflict series, which I create new videos in every single month, taking deeper dives into more recent, controversial, and darker subject material surrounding modern wars, operations, and conflicts. Over the past 4 years, I've personally created nearly 50 total episodes in Modern Conflicts covering topics as diverse as the U.S.'s manhunt for Osama bin Laden and the pathway that led up to that point in the 9/11 attacks. An hour-by-hour analysis into the events that took place during Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th and Israel's subsequent full-scale invasion of Gaza, along with how the U.S. led a coalition that eventually destroyed ISIS across Iraq and Syria, how the U.S. military campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan began and evolved with time, and dozens of other episodes with brand new ones like the manhunt for El Chapo coming out every single month, all exclusively on Nebula. Because of the inherently violent, controversial, and recent nature of discussing the details of the manhunt for arguably the most wanted violent criminal of the entire 21st century, this episode covering the manhunt for El Chapo would never work on YouTube, because it would instantly be demonetized and age-restricted, which means that YouTube's algorithm, which is based on showing you ads, would never be incentivized to actually show the video to you or promote it. I deal with very large numbers of my videos on YouTube getting demonetized and age-restricted as they are. And that's why I upload all of my episodes of Modern Conflicts exclusively to Nebula, and why signing up to Nebula is the absolute best thing that you can do to support me and my channel. And you'll get access to way more content there than just my exclusive Modern Conflict series as well, because the best part about Nebula is that it's jointly co-owned by myself and hundreds of other independent creators that empower us to make the projects that we're deeply excited about without any fear of being censored or demonetized like we are on YouTube. And that's why there's tons of other new unique content on Nebula that's coming out all the time too that you'll also love. Like Neo's Underexposure series, Wendover Productions' The Logistics of X series, TLDR News' What to Follow USA series, and so many others. I also know that there's a lot of streaming platforms out there right now and you don't want to get stuck with another monthly cost to keep track of. But I also know that if you watch this all the way through to the end, there is so much content on Nebula that you'll love as well, and so much more coming out with every new month, that you could consider a lifetime membership to Nebula as well. You just pay once, and then you'll get lifetime access to everything that I and hundreds of other creators will ever produce on Nebula for as long as we both last, and you'll never have to worry about a recurring subscription or ads ever again. That's the best way possible to support what I'm doing here on Real Life's Lore. But even if you'd rather not make that large an upfront commitment, you can still help support me by signing up for a yearly or monthly subscription to Nebula as well, which you can get right now for a fantastic deal with 40% off by scanning the QR code or by clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by following the link that's down below in the description, any of which will also get you access to everything that's on Nebula for the very low price of just $3 per month, or $36 a year. I hope that you'll consider signing up. And as always, thank you so much for watching.